WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. COVID-19 is again spiking in Virginia, and humans are not the only ones affected. Harrisonburg breaks ground on a new fire station, and improv comedy is alive and well in the Valley. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, August 1st. Virginia's sales and use tax holiday for school supplies, clothing, and energy-efficient goods begins tomorrow and runs through Sunday. During that time, the 4.3% sales tax on those items will be suspended. COVID-19 is again spiking in Virginia. WHSV reports that part of the reason is that fewer people are getting vaccine boosters, according to the Central Shenandoah Health District. And humans are not the only ones experiencing a spike in COVID cases. A study from the Wildlife Center of Virginia and Virginia Tech found that wild animals are testing positive for COVID-19. Some animals impacted include raccoons, groundhogs, Virginia possum, deer mice, and eastern cottontail rabbits. Harrisonburg broke ground on a new fire station Tuesday morning, WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
First responders and city leaders gathered in a field on Mount Clinton Pike to break ground on the fifth fire station in town. Retired Fire Chief Larry Shiflett told WMRA there's been a need for this station since the area northwest of downtown joined the city as part of a 1983 annexation.
Every other area of the city has a response time that is less than the response time to the Parkview area. People don't realize how critical seconds and minutes are when you have a fire.
Their goal is to cut response times in this area from 6 minutes to 4. Chief Matthew Tobia said they partnered with mathematicians at James Madison University to identify the best location to serve that goal.
When a person's heart stops beating, we have about 4 minutes to be able to initiate effective CPR. We need to be there fast. The other thing that happens is that fires burn so intensely today. Everything is a synthetic fiber. Synthetic fibers are resilient, but they contain a tremendous amount of unburned energy.
Captain Joe Weaver is overseeing the project for the fire department. They hope to open the station in under a year, by next June.
When I started 24 years ago, Station 5 was a dream of Chief Shiflett, who hired me. So to see him retire and now to see this come true, you know, it's very bittersweet.
The project will cost more than $8 million, including the land purchase, construction costs, and a new fire engine. $5 million of that was allocated from American Rescue Plan Act funds. Ongoing expenses will include salaries for 15 fire personnel. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
We posted photographs of the event at WMRA.org and on the app. NPR is reporting that Project 2025's director is leaving the Conservative Heritage Foundation. The project has outlined authoritarian policy proposals for an incoming Republican administration. Jad Khalil with VPM News reports on the project's Virginia connections.
Three of Project 2025's policy book authors have strong Virginia ties. There's a former attorney general, an energy lobbyist who represents clients at the Virginia Capitol, and an appointee to the George Mason University Board of Visitors. Governor Glenn Youngkin has appointed others that worked for organizations on the project's advisory board to positions ranging from the Board of Physical Therapy to the Virginia Council on Women.
It's really important to look at the relationships that Heritage has formed.
Don Abelson is a professor at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, and a think tank expert.
The fact that the governor of Virginia is associated with Heritage is not a surprise. The kind of blueprints that Heritage provides and builds on can have an impact across the United States.
Youngkin's spokesperson said in a statement that all his appointees are, quote, exceptionally qualified.
Jad Khalil reporting. Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley was in Richmond Wednesday morning supporting former President Donald Trump's 2024 campaign. Among the promises made by Trump so far is a vow to let states decide for themselves on the issue of abortion, but not everyone believes the former president. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
Well, President Trump has said very clearly that this needs to be a state issue.
That's RNC Chairman Michael Whatley at McLean's Diner near downtown Richmond. And here's Trump earlier this year reinforcing that stance.
And whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
Watley made the morning stop as part of a tour of states he said were in play ahead of the 2024 election. But elected Democrats in the Commonwealth questioned Trump's promise to keep abortion a state issue.
He has proven that he is a chameleon, and he will say whatever he feels like people want to hear in order to get whatever it is that he wants.
That's Norfolk State Senator Angela Williams-Graves. She joined Richmond Congresswoman Jennifer McClellan in casting doubt on Trump's promise to keep the federal government out of women's health care decisions. McClellan pointed to proposals from Republicans in the House and Senate submitted in 2022, which would limit the procedure to 15 weeks nationwide.
He has not said he wouldn't sign a ban if it got to his desk. He has shown us who he is, and we need to believe him.
A late 2023 poll saw 60% of registered Virginia voters say abortion is very important to their vote, a 14% increase from 2019. Early voting in the 2024 presidential election in Virginia begins in September. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
The recount for a Republican nominee in Virginia's 5th congressional district starts this morning at 7:30. Election officials will retally roughly 7,500 votes from the June 18th primary between incumbent Congressman Bob Good and State Senator John McGuire. Good, who is paying for the recount, filed a petition in July contesting the initial results. He lost to McGuire by 374 votes. More than 62,000 ballots were cast in the multi-million dollar race. That includes more than $10 million of outside campaign spending. A federal court is ordering the release of several people in Virginia caught up in the immigration system. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
A handful of immigrants are being released from detention in Virginia now that a federal court in Alexandria is approving a settlement of a class action lawsuit between immigration officials and the American Civil Liberties Union. The immigrants already won their court cases in Virginia, but the ICE field office in Washington was detaining them anyway. Austin Rose is an attorney at the Amica Center's Immigration Impact Lab.
These are people who won their cases. The judge said, yes, this person has provided evidence to prove that they will be persecuted or tortured in their country, and therefore they cannot be deported to that country. Yet, until now, ICE has continued to detain the vast majority of those people.
Sophia Gregg is an immigrants' rights attorney with the ACLU of Virginia.
This is about holding the government accountable, you know, when they're violating people's due process rights as well, right? There's a process by which people seek legal status in this country. Should they win, they should be afforded the right to be free.
Four detainees have already been released, and dozens more are expected in the next few months. Michael Pope.
Prison reform efforts in Virginia have led to thousands of inmates being released, and with that comes a different set of needs for housing the incarcerated. To that end, the state has taken control of the lone privately owned prison in Virginia. Brad Kuttner has the story.
We believe that we can run Lawrenceville safer, more efficiently, and provide some things that maybe weren't available there.
That's Chad Dotson, director of Virginia's Department of Corrections, on his hopes for Lawrenceville Correctional Center, which is south of Richmond near the North Carolina line. Once owned by a private company, the state assumed control of the facility today. It's something prison reform advocates like Delegate Irene Shin have long been waiting for.
I'm excited about seeing what he might be able to do as he thinks about what does it mean to be forward-thinking and forward-looking.
Shin was talking about promised reforms from Dotson, and while the director wasn't able to divulge much of his plans yet, he did offer some insights.
What we're trying to do is create a community where the inmates will take control for the safety and security of the facility, and in exchange, they get opportunities.
Among those who are glad to hear about the transfer is Sean Moneta. He's an advocate with the Humanization Project and himself a former inmate at Lawrenceville.
There are some things that need to be done to sort of accommodate for these soft skills that you lose while you're incarcerated.
Moneta hopes future plans include more job training and readiness programs that can help people acclimate better. But such programs aren't cheap. That's where Senator Adam Eben comes in. He's been asking the state to assume control over Lawrenceville for about 7 years. And while he's pleased it's happening, he said it's time for elected officials to step up.
There's a lot of needs, but there's limited financial resources, so we have to be smart and see if we can't allocate some more.
Dotson said some work, like prison transfers, was already underway. More details about future reforms are expected in the fall. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Improvisational comedy has early roots in ancient Rome. Skip ahead 2,000 years, and people are still marveling at performers who entertain with no script. In the Valley, improv comedy is alive and well with Rocktown Improv, a collective of comedy performers who put on a show every first Friday at Court Square Theater in Harrisonburg. WMRE's Chris Borrow spoke with two members of the troupe, Jonathan Stewart and John Huffman. Chris asked Jonathan about his introduction to improv comedy.
We did a bunch of plays at our high school where the licensing was loose. So our director of these shows just let us kind of say whatever we wanted sometimes. So we started improvising lines in some of these sort of lesser known plays. And then sort of more formally in college, was introduced to it by some friends. I studied theater in undergrad.
Do you remember the first time you got on stage to do improv and what that was like?
It's exciting, right? It's exhilarating. It's different than, you know, having a script in hand to be able to get out there and just sort of be in a scene and make something happen.
My first time was horrifying. So I don't know what Jonathan's talking about. It was not fun at all. I was terrified the whole time. No, I'm kidding. I do remember the early days. I unfortunately have some video proof of the early days.
Oh, we need to see that.
It's erased. In fact, I'm going to need the recording of this. Saying that I have a recording of that because it was that bad. But creating together on stage something that is unscripted is something I love doing then. I love doing now. Yeah, improv is just great.
It can be a little terrifying, though.
Yeah, you know? I mean, that's the sort of the exhilarating piece for me is that, like, sometimes it is horrible, right? So there's, like, I mean, it's either, like, you're going to have these moments, you know, everything is flowing and it feels perfect, or you find yourself in a situation where you're like, this isn't working. I know it's not working. And I'm going to remember this 30 years from now. But you don't, right? So that's, like, you do improv enough and it's the failures become, you know, lessons, and the wins become, you know, things to celebrate.
Well, I'm sold, Jonathan. he's absolutely right about those moments. There's like a shame barrier that you break through a little bit. But also, as opposed to some other things that you're doing on stage, like stand up, you have trust that you have for the people that you're doing it with, kind of can overcome those things. And so it ends up being this moment where, you know, you're on stage, the audience is rooting for you, your fellow improvisers are rooting for you, and you're engaged in the act of creation together. And I think that's the beauty of it.
Can you talk about the history of Rocktown Improv, how it got started, how long it's been going on?
Some of us have been doing improv together off and on for over 10 years, but Rocktown itself, pre-COVID, Bethany and Steve, some of our collaborators and performers in the group, had gotten together wanting to bring some folks together in a sort of collective type of format, right? Like a leaderless movement, to have it be like an open space where people could just come and meet one another. They had reached out to some other folks that they had done improv with in the past, and we put out some calls and just sort of open invite for folks to come hang out and do some open practices. And that's sort of how the collective kind of popped up. And at this point, we have two performance groups that have come out of it quarterly at this point that we do sort of open practices where we say to folks, you know, anyone come join, learn about improv, get to meet some other people and laugh together.
And Rocktown Improv does a first Friday show just about every month. And tomorrow you'll be performing at Court Square Theater. So what's the show like?
Our first Friday shows are your kind of classic short form improv that you might see in the televised sort of popular improv. And we'll probably do 10 or 11 games or so.
Do you pull audience members up to play with you guys?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we usually have at least one or two audience participation games in every one of our first Friday shows.
Is there a favorite game for you, each of you?
I think so. Those shows are great because they kind of incorporate a lot of different styles of improv. Mm-hmm. So you've got the short, gamey scenes. But I think, I'm going to speak for you, Jonathan, I think some of my favorites are the ones where it's just a longer scene.
Yeah, I think John and I share that sort of love for the sort of simple scene games where we have a chance to sort of build a thing. If the scene goes well, the audience will love it, right? But the audiences do, I think, tend to like some of the silly games that have a restriction built into them. But games like Questions Only. And when I'm teaching improv to groups, whether that's kids or in professional settings, it's one of those things that, you know, we try to start with some of the basic rules of yes and for the time being, try to not ask questions. So when you introduce a game, that's like the whole point is asking questions.
Yeah.
It can be become tricky to break out of some of those habits, especially for new improvisers.
That was the first part of our interview with Jonathan Stewart and John Huffman from Rocktown Improv. And later this afternoon, Chris Boros will bring you part two, and Kimberly Daggy has part three during All Things Considered. To hear the full interview and to get details of their show tomorrow night at Court Square Theater in Harrisonburg, visit WMRA.org. Finally today, King's Dominion announced it will open the world's tallest and longest launched wing roller coaster in 2025. At 145 feet tall and more than a half mile long, the Raptura will offer, quote, the sensation of flight during its 89-second ride. Upon launch, passengers will accelerate to 65 miles per hour in 4 seconds. The attraction is scheduled for completion this fall and will open next year as part of the Hanover County Park's 50th anniversary season. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Thursday.